I'm, for those of you who have not seen me before, I'm John Beckett, and I'm going to sort of, I'm not going to really chair a round table here. First of all, we don't have a round table, as you've noticed.
Or any knights.
Or any knights, thank you. I'm simply going to ask the various participants along the table to say a few words about how they, about you know, what they brought to the conference, what they think they can get from the conference, and if there's a time at the end, we'll open it to discussion. But the fear is that David Bates has already told me this, that there will be the clinking of glasses out there, and after two long days of conference, the thought of a drink to keep you going is probably going to be all that you'll need. I'm not even going to introduce the speakers. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, say who they are, and say their piece, and we'll just move along the table, starting with Paula at the end. Paula.
Okay. I'm Paula Hamilton from the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. It's always a temptation to say too much when you've got such a short session, but however. I've got four quick points to make. The first is an observation that the conference is titled History in the Public, and I can see that across the conference it's provided a framework for people from different institutional sectors to speak to each other and to find common ground. So I found it really interesting to see people from galleries, archives, museums, local histories talking to each other and exploring their relationship with the academy. There are also, there's another strand of people in at the conference I noticed who are identified as public historians, quite specifically, and they've also had a sort of audience commentary as well as been giving papers, and they have a different sense of the role of history in the public. The cultural institutions from which many of the participants have been drawn have tended to focus on the visual arts and material culture. And so for me, the central problem, I suppose, or the what I'd like to have seen addressed is the oral and perhaps the oral, not only because that has been so pervasively and is pervasively used in a huge range of institutions, but because I believe it has become central to public history as a practice and, of course, by a number of publics. There's also the spectre at the feast, which is the popular, but we can talk about that. The second point I want to make is that this exploration of history in the public is happening at the very moment when our understanding of what is the public and the notion of a public sphere is being reconstituted through new communication technologies, as was mentioned this morning by the archivists. And in particular, spatially, I think, our understanding of what is public and what is private is undergoing a revolution. And so what we become aware of in a conference like this is that the public is not... Internet is not just a boon for greater access, nor even a means of creating different kinds of historical sources, but how we understand, interpret and communicate history is completely changing. The third point is to ask questions about audiences for the many of us who are speaking from the point of view of producers of public history. It seemed to me that one of the issues that we would be important to address is the question of who is this public, these various audiences, and what do they bring to this engagement as the public. I'm reminded that people are never just spectators of history, that whenever they engage with some historical representation, they are always reimagining it mentally. So it's a mental act on their part. So it would be good to explore in the future some sense of that, the level of that engagement. John Tosh was speaking yesterday about the desire for a public who is better informed historically, and his issues were really about what they know, which I think is very important. Mine would also be about how they know and the forms of historical understanding they bring to the range of histories we present in the public, in the public domain. And that, of course, is to ask questions about how historical consciousness or historical sensibilities are being shaped and shifting across various forms. Finally, I would like to raise what I see as the greatest challenge, and this is just far too difficult to raise, but I can't help it, epistemologically to academic history and to historians in general. And that, of course, to go back to the old, is the role of what John Tosh mentioned yesterday as the partisan history. Because I think the challenges to history in the public presented by not just by witnessing, by testimony, and by forms of oral evidence, is just presenting great difficulties to the historical profession. Part of the reason for that is that the past and present have collapsed. That the question of historical distance, which used to be the temporal distance, which was once the central plank of the historian's craft, is now seen as something to be overcome. And I see that partly as a result of using new methods like oral history. But quite simply, we have to engage much more often now with the question of what happens when the past is lived in the present. Even though there are groups where this has always happened, we can think of Ireland, Armenia, etc., etc. So I guess I'll leave it there and let others talk. We can take it up in discussion.
We're going to be very democratic and just move down the table. So Simon next.
Okay, thanks. Simon Ditchfield, University of York, UK. It's now almost exactly 10 years ago that I started a three-year project called Heritage Studies as Applied History. And the idea of this project was to, among other things, was to really get academic history departments to integrate into their programs courses that looked at the sort of extra academic consumption and engagement with the past. And I immediately was struck by a problem of the title. And I was challenged again and again and again by members, particularly people from the old university sector, i.e. the pre-1992 institutions, of what on earth I meant by applied history. How could history be applied? It would inevitably compromise its value. And really, here it links back to, I think, a challenge laid down to us by, put forward to us by John Tosh, the challenge of relevance. And I want to link with that the point made by Charles Sir Maurice Smith and brought out by Luigi Giordanova, the need we should have for an institutional, sort of historicized institutional awareness of how our own activities are limited and shaped by the institutions we're part of, whether it be museums, media, universities, school, or whatever. And going back to my project, one of the things that really had kept me, really got me interested in this topic at the beginning is I'm a research-wise historian of early modern Italy, in particular uses of the Christian past. And I was particularly interested that if we look at the history of heritage and the heritage of history, they actually do their processes and their discourses indeed are interwoven in the past and not at all separate. And one of the things I felt myself trying to exorcise was something I call the curse of Leopold von Ranke, the idea that somehow if you're not talking about constructing narratives of nation-building derring-do, it's not really proper history. And it's got to be scientific positivistic history. And I think this is condemned to oblivion so much of the, and it's really divided the antiquarians from the true historians in a very damaging way. And to my mind, I think really what we need to do is come off the sort of fence of objectivity before the iron completely sort of takes over our soul, and really need to engage and really, you know, come out as people who are saying, right, let's be partisan. Let's be passionate but argue something and really... here I would also just allude briefly to the sort of origins of scientific history in the Western tradition, which many historians would agree are to be found in the historical polemics that surround the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, and really the way in which history was born out of polemic, and a lot of the techniques that are used now daily by us historians as professionals. And I think if we don't engage with people, we've got to make arguments and we've got to debate. And I don't agree with someone on the BBC who said yesterday, the media want to be fed single lines. I mean, I tried to do right at the beginning, get over to students that really we don't do answers in humanities, we do issues. And I think we're doing a disservice to the general public and the various publics if we believe they can't take or engage with an argument. So it's really an appeal for us to exorcise the ghost of von Ranke.
Thank you. Peter, would you like to go?
Yeah, hi. I'm Peter Stanley from the Australian War Memorial, where I've been since 1980, so I'm a practicing public historian. I'd like to offer some reflections, having listened to 2 days of this conference, listening to people talking about ways of relating to their various publics. It seems to me that historians' relationship with their publics is mediated through other institutions or other bodies, publishers, museums, television producers and companies, essentially entities which historians don't control. Now, history, as I suggested yesterday, is a supremely democratic discipline, but it's also a very individual discipline. All of us offer interpretations and arguments which are personal. Autonomy, I think, is very important to historians. But in order to convey that autonomous personal view, historians have to engage through and with those intermediaries, publishers, museums, television organizations. It seems that most control can be retained through the least popular product, scholarly books and articles, for example. It's entirely up to us what we say. But as audiences and budgets increase, historians' individual autonomy is often compromised or diluted. Add to that, of course, the inherent constraints of the various forms, the unavoidable tyranny of the text panel, the length of it, the limitations of screen time, iPods, a technology we've just introduced into our galleries. The form dictates the tone. Those constraints limit the historian's freedom of manoeuvre. So I'd like to offer Stanley's third law of public history. An historian's autonomy declines in direct relation to the magnitude of the audience. And I think that law obtains until it reaches a point, and let's call it the Sharma point, at which the critical turning point becomes the magnitude of the historian. So public history, it seems, is really a matter of control. It's a matter of contestation, of engaging in a contest with institutions like the ones we work for or companies like television companies with whom we work. And my question is, and it's a question I pose to myself, is are we prepared to engage in that contest of control in order to reach the autonomy which is so important to us?
Thank you very much. Yeah. I'm John Hamer, and most of my affiliations now begin with the word formally. So I was formerly one of Her Majesty's Inspectors of Schools with particular responsibility for history, and I was also formerly Education Policy Advisor to the Heritage Lottery Fund. So my background is very much in terms of history teaching in schools. And one of the things that's concerned me for some time in that area, and which I think certainly the last 2 days have caused me to reflect upon further, is why history teaching in schools doesn't seem to be as effective as it should be in terms of connecting with public history in its various forms, and in particular in terms of drawing strength from those various public histories. And I think there are possibly a whole variety of reasons for this, some of which are highly practical, I don't really want to go into here, but others which seem to me to be much more fundamental about the way in which government, society, the public, whatever kind of general terminology one wishes to use, the way in which they see schools' roles in history teaching. And I want to pick out two or three factors in particular. One, it seems to me, which is very significant, is that on the whole, And these are gross generalisations, I appreciate. But on the whole, schools are not quite trusted to teach history. There is a kind of ongoing fear or underlying fear that history may become some kind of indoctrination or some kind of propaganda. And you may remember that in the early days of the national curriculum in history, one Secretary of State very famously decided that history ended 20 years ago from today, and that any history after that was simply current affairs. This was slightly better than some of my medievalist friends, who actually regarded everything post-1485 as current affairs, but actually was not very helpful if one was going to get schools to come back to something that John Tosh was saying right at the beginning of the conference, if one was going to get schools to consider the way in which history might throw light upon and inform current events and current activities. But there's been a kind of underlying fear that if you allowed schools and history teachers to go down that direction, that all kinds of awful things might happen. So increasingly, I think there has been attempts to control, and that's one of the reasons. The second, it seems to me, are the whole range of issues which hang around the notion of heritage and the problematic nature of heritage. I mean, by and large, I think the... That hasn't been something which has been touched upon in any kind of depth in the last 2 days, at least not in the bits that I've been to. But history teachers and those who were responsible for devising the national curriculum in history have been very wary about using the word heritage. Indeed, the original draws up of the national curriculum specifically said they weren't going to talk about heritage, they weren't going to use the word heritage, although in fact they did in various other means, but they were concerned about the use of heritage and the problematic nature of it. And there are still many, I think, who would share those kinds of concerns, that school should be the transmitters of heritage is somehow to sort of sanitize or trivialize the past, that it's sometimes seen as a very sinister motive for teaching history. One of my former bosses in the inspectorate once described references to heritage as the last resort of the despot, or too often the last resort of the despot. And feelings perhaps as well that heritage, the notion of heritage, was not appropriate when one was dealing with very diverse and pluralistic societies with a multiplicity of identities and so on. So heritage is by and large a word which has been eschewed amongst history teachers, seen as slightly off-beam. And if one goes to conferences of history teachers in schools, I doubt whether the word heritage would appear, except very rarely, whereas in this conference it's been used quite considerably. And I think the third problem that history has within schools in terms of latching on to the public interest and public history is the notion that really the job that schools should be doing is actually transmitting a core of essential, unquestioned knowledge about the past. Quite what that core consists of course, varies, and there are various agents ranging from, and I don't put these in any particular order, but ranging from the Daily Mail to David Starkey, who are insistent that there is a specific core of knowledge which it's the job of schools to hand on and not to question. So that any attempt to move away from that in terms of developing skills, analytical skills within the schools, or in terms of, as the qualifications and curriculum authority is currently attempting to do, to draw up a more wide-ranging approach to at least in one form, to GCSE examining, that's seen in some quarters anyway as dumbing down and not really the job that schools should be doing. So this conference, as I say, has enabled me to reflect, I think, further on issues of that kind and to return to my original concern, which is ways in which schools' history teaching might more effectively draw upon and draw strength from public history.
Thank you very much. Liz. Thank you. I'm Liz Hallam-Smith. Until recently, I worked at the National Archives, and I've recently moved to the House of Lords as Director of Information Services and Librarian. I'd like to pick up on some themes already raised in the panel. I would contend that today, professional and academic history has a pretty low profile with the UK public as a whole. And yet today, history as a subject and a pursuit is vastly popular. Some three-quarters of the population actually indulges in historical activities every year. There's actually only one public history course in the UK. Now, as a symptom of all this, let's take two current TV programmes. The first one is Who Do You Think You Are? Now, how many of you have watched Who Do You Think You Are? And do you like Who Do You Think You Are? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's great, actually. I am biased, but I think it's great. One conference participant, when I was discussing this earlier, said it's inquiry-based learning. It's informative, it's well-researched, as well as being popular. Now, the format and content of this series, they were heavily influenced by the Archive Awareness Campaign, and also by family historians, including the Federation of Family History Societies and the Society of Genealogists. Now, I'm not quite sure where the historians were in the planning, and they certainly don't seem to appear very much on the programmes. Now, my second programme, which I'd like to raise with you, is The Virgin Queen. How many of you will admit to having watched it? Now, the big question, how many of you liked it? I have a great quote from the scriptwriter, Paula Mill, and sorry for those who've already heard this, but it's worth reading out again. It's wonderful. She used, Paula Mill, the scriptwriter, used horrible histories as her main source for Virgin Queen, according to the Sunday Times. She says in her interview, school teachers are better and more objective than modern historians, because school teachers wrote horrible histories.
Disgraceful.
She says, when historians like Starkey or Alison Weir bring out their books on Elizabeth, they've a line or opinion they're plugging to sell them. But teachers don't embellish. They're far more objective. Well, where were the historians? Now, to be fair, we do have David Starkey and Simon Sharma as household names, but are most academic historians too busy with the research assessment exercise to engage with broader historians? So my question for the historians in the audience is, should historians have our own awareness campaign like the archivists? Should such a campaign promote our role in public history? Should we seek to engage with a broad public? Should we mount an advocacy campaign for the subject to try and influence opinion formers? We could stress the value and the values of history. Such a campaign would not be dumbing down, but it would be restating the value of our subject to society.
Thank you. Don?
Don Henson, Council for British Archaeology. I've just got three sort of observations, really, and things that have occurred to me throughout these last 2 days that have come to my mind, many of which have already been picked up on in discussions in various sessions. The first is that the past itself doesn't recognise the boundaries that we do. Archaeology, history, architectural history, archives, museums, whatever it is. The past is holistic. Yet we have a community which is divided into different specialisms that approaches the past in different ways. I think if we are to successfully engage with the publics and the individuals who make up that public, then we have to do a lot more collaborative working. And I'm encouraged by the sheer variety of people here at these last 2 days who come from different sectors within the history stroke heritage area. And I really would like to encourage more of that to happen. I think that's vitally important. My second observation is that we have two quite separate things as a commodity that we deal in. Partly we have the product of what we do as historians or archaeologists or architectural historians or archivists or whatever it is. The narratives, the interpretations, the sites, the artifacts. And the products are attractive, They're interesting. People want to see them. They want to handle them. They want to touch them, etc. But we also have a set of processes. We have skills. And those processes, historical processes, archaeological skills, etc., are ones that we must also try to get across. It's not just a question, I think, of sharing the products of what we do. I think we need to share the processes of how we do what we do. And to me, public history isn't about giving people things. It's about empowering people out there to do the history and the archaeology for themselves and to become their own historians, their own investigators of the past. And certainly the CBA's main mission in life is archaeology for all, to get more and more people involved in doing it for themselves. And I would like to see that as a core aim of public history, to get not just a profession of a few thousand people, but many millions of people doing, actively investigating the past for themselves. And that needn't be a threat to our professional identity in any way whatsoever. And that leads me into my final point, which is that we here are the committed. We believe in the public. We have a lot of colleagues who don't. And I can think of a lot of archaeologists in my profession who would run a mile and rather not have to deal with the public. And I know some archaeological organisations who refuse to engage in outreach work or education work, for example. And I'm sure that we could all think of historians and archivists and others who would be likewise, that if you ask them... I once had have a dream of mine, which goes back to when I was a museum education officer, which is to put every archaeologist in the country, and especially all the directors of archaeological units and county archaeologists, in front of a class of 10-year-olds. And just give them 5 or 10 minutes in front of a class of 10-year-olds and ask them to explain what they do. And a large number of them would simply run away and wouldn't be able to do it. And they're frightened of it. And I think that is one of the main challenges we've got, is actually to convert our own colleagues to with the same missionary zeal that I think we have here. And unless we do that, we will be actively obstructed in actually getting at the public. And there are projects I can think of where colleagues have obstructed public history, public archaeology. That's my three observations.
Right, I'll just sum that up very quickly. First of all, I'd just like to thank all the six people who have spoken for the very...